From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on an airplane, 30,000 feet above the Pacific time zone. A tall, sturdy, and friendly man had spied an astronomy textbook on the lap of his seatmate. He asked, "You're a scientist?" The seatmate was indeed a scientist, astrophysicist Adam Frank of the University of Rochester, the man who created and writes NPR's Cosmos and Culture blog. They struck up a conversation on that airplane. The burly passenger then asked, "Are you involved in that big controversy over climate?" For Adam Frank, it was an opportunity. He detected in his seatmate an open mind, a friendliness, a curiosity. So instead of deflecting the conversation and going back to his reading, Adam replied, "What controversy?" And that launched a discussion that would dominate their time on that airplane. For Adam Frank, it was a window in what we might call the gap. That gap between what the public perceives about what the scientific community thinks about the climate and the reality of what the scientific community really thinks about the climate. Over the past year, Adam Frank has increasingly focused his NPR writing on climate change, even though he's not a paleoclimatologist himself. And he recently wrote a piece that urged all of us not to feel so gloomy about climate science, but instead to celebrate it as one of the great achievements of mankind. He's my guest for the hour, and we have a lot to talk about. Welcome back to Connections, Adam.
It's great to be here again.
Can we start on that airplane? I'm fascinated with this story because most of the time when I'm on an airplane, you know, I like to be friendly, but I also, it's a good chance to get work done.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't have kids with you, you can read. And this guy wanted to ask you, it seemed like a very earnest question.
You know,
what about the controversy?
Right.
And how did it go?
Well, and that's, you know, usually, right, I usually just keep my head down. I don't usually want to get involved in this conversation. But there was something about him. He was a really genial kind of Midwestern guy. And, you know, the thing that struck me about it was, right, he was saying, you know, he came at it with like, "Oh, yeah, you must be part of that big controversy." And this is what, you know, what happens with the media and the general public perception about climate is that, like, there's this huge argument going on within climate science. And that's what I was telling this guy, dude, within climate science, for the people who actually study climate science, who spend their life with it, who publish papers in the respectable journals, et cetera, that debate ended decades ago. Right. And so it's this, you know, what happens for us in science is that it's like there's this alternate reality that we're living in. Every day we go to work and, you know, we talk to our friends who are in climate and we do whatever research we do, which is associated with climate. We see like, yeah, this question's been answered. And then you go outside and it's like suddenly, you know, people are asking you about this thing going on, which you're like, this isn't going on at all. You know,
last night on Twitter, someone said to me, "Well, I wish you'd have somebody who denies that on and have a nice, solid debate." And I said, "Well, they did that like 20 years ago, you know?" And so to me, the response I had was, "Is the sky blue? The sky is blue. And now, is the sky royal blue or cobalt blue?
Right.
Is it light blue or dark blue? That's sort of where we are.
What can
be done? What can't be done? How fast can it be done? But is the sky blue? The sky is blue.
Exactly. That's what it is. I mean, the problem is with, you know, it's like asking someone to say, "Hey, you know, could you add 2 and 3 together?" And it's like, "Oh, I got 5. Yeah. Oh, hey, could you do that again? It's 5. You know, then you ask them like 58 times. It's like, "Look, dude, it's 5. Okay, this isn't interesting to us anymore." And the basic question of is the climate changing and is it due to human activity? That's been answered so long ago that to have like somebody else show up here and debate about it would be basically like saying, "Oh, should we have a debate? Should we talk about cigarette smoking and have someone from the tobacco company and tell us that no, cigarette smoking, there's still some debate about that, about whether it's, you know, bad for you." We're so far past that point.
And, you know, I think what you just mentioned, the parallel to cigarette smoking, is an apt one simply because whenever we have seen science start to explain possible harm, there has been a pushback from moneyed interests. And this is, again, this is not, I hope our listeners don't think the host is being partisan on this. No, this is just history. Lead is a perfect example.
Right.
It took a lot longer than the scientists and the researchers who finally figured lead out thought it would take to start moving in other directions. And cigarette smoking is a good example. What did the tobacco industry do? So this is not a surprise that it goes this way.
Right.
But we're in the midst of it. And so you're on this airplane. And I think it sounded to me when I read your piece on the NPR Cosmos and Culture blog, like, you know, you'll talk about this if someone is absolutely open to it and just has the wrong idea.
Right.
You know, you're not there to debate it.
Right.
But it is important to let the public know, you know, more.
Well, that's why I'm hoping we're doing today is we're talking about sort of the state of climate science, how we got there, sort of what goes on around it that it's you know, why aren't we at the point where, like, we are with smoking? Like, okay, look, this is done. Now let's get on to the other issue. But, you know, the first thing we have to address is this weird alternate reality. You know, I like to think of it as, you know, if you had a company that did, you know, that you were a plumbing company and you made U-joints, and, you know, every day you went to work and your U-joints were selling great. Everyone loved your U-joints. And then everywhere you went in the world, you'd meet these people like, hey, man, I'm really sorry about those U-joints. What are you talking about? You know, so people have to understand how frustrating it is to be for climate science in particular, to be constantly barraged with this thing about, like, oh, you know, this debate, this ongoing debate. And we're like, this has nothing to do with my actual reality as a climate scientist. There are virtually, you know, I can on my right hand, I can tell you the climate scientists who still are going to publicly argue against, and these are the ones who always get dragged up, Willie Soon, you know, the vast majority of climate scientists are all way past this issue, working on other aspects of climate, you know, arguing with each other about the details, but, you know, this basic issue is done.
And for you, your own career has had a very interesting up-close look at this, and I'd like to go back to the early to mid-80s, for example, because even if you weren't at NASA at the time, you had a really interesting chance to see what was developing. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, this was actually, I graduated from University of Colorado in 1984, and then I had a year and a half off. I took a gap year, and for a while, I was just doing stupid jobs in New York City. You know, I was a bouncer at the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I was a foot messenger, and then I was like, oh, God, just give me a job in science. I would have done anything. I would have, like, you know, done Twinkie recipes. I didn't care. But I lucked out and I got this job. I didn't know this. There's the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, which is a NASA installation on 113th Street and Broadway, right next to the diner where Seinfeld, you know, that Seinfeld diner? It's right above it. And so what is a NASA installation doing in you know, Manhattan? So I got a job there as a scientific programmer, which is basically, you know, you come in and they just, whatever little piece of programming they need, you do. And I'd been there for a while, and you know, after about, like, 2 months, I went up and I asked my boss, Inez Fung, who's now a very famous climate scientist, I said, you know, what exactly are we doing here? You know, like, what are we studying? And she sat me down and she explained to me that they, you know, the codes I was helping build were part of this big climate model, and they had been studying for the last 10 years the Earth's climate, because it already, from other models, people were pretty clear that the CO2 was going to change the atmosphere and that it was going to be warming. And this was at the point in 1985 where the signal hadn't appeared for it. She said, we're looking for the signal, which was the signal, the temperature signal rising above the noise. And she said, and then she laid out what they thought would happen and everything. And I remember being like, oh my God. Like, you know, I went home and I'm like, you know, I was at a bar the next night, like, dude, like, you know, we're warming up the planet. So, you know, that was it was amazing what she told me that. And this was before anybody, like, I was the first guy of anybody knew to talk about climate change, right? Nobody else had ever heard of it. They're like, and my other friend's like, wow, dude, that's wild, you know? So, and so I've been watching my whole life since Inez told me that and said, oh, we're looking for the signal. You know, for the last 30 years, I've been watching the progress of this science. And, you know, around the mid-90s, the signal became very apparent. And now the signal is so apparent, it's ridiculous. So it's like I have this very long baseline in watching the progress of, in particular, the progress of climate science. Because where the computer models were at then, I mean, literally, you had to go down to the computer room. And there were those big, like, sort of in Star Trek, the big computers with the disks on that whirred back and forth. I mean, this was very old school science. But where we've gone from then to now has been remarkable. And the case being just solid is also remarkable, how solid that case is.
How fascinating for you to be there at Goddard when this is happening, because throughout history, you go back to a time before we were able to see down to the cellular level. And somebody at some point, and I don't even know what century we're going back to, realized that, you know, it's not deities that are giving you a cough or a sneeze or a disease. They knew it had to be there somewhere down at the cellular level, but they couldn't quite see it yet. But they knew, we're going to be looking for this. And then eventually they found it.
Right.
And that moment has to be amazing. That whole scenario plays out with looking for that signal.
Right.
Because they knew,
right,
you know, if we're right, we're going to see this signal eventually. Yeah. And you start to see that in the 90s. So in a sense, it had to be, I hate to use this, it had to be cool to see it at the same time.
It was. No,
you know, not
it was
the kind of thing you hope they're wrong.
Right,
but,
right,
know,
right. But no, it was pretty amazing because I was learning all about the science. I was learning, you know, and at one point, you know, what's awesome about it too is they were originally, you know, they knew they had to take the full Earth into account. So at one point they had me go out and I had to find out where all the cows and sheep on the entire planet were, right? Because they fart And the farting actually had to take into account the methane from the farting. So I had to go to the Columbia Library and spend a week in there finding all the records of where all the cows were. So already then they were trying to build full global models that had all the effects in it. And so watching where we are now, where we, you know, the computer models are amazing in their resolution and all the physics that's built into them. But it was amazing in that sense.
Now, this is just coincidence, but next hour on this program, we're talking about what it means to be a dairy farmer in 2015.
So, yeah, you know, so, ruminants.
There you go. We're talking to Adam Frank. He's my guest for the hour. He is the co-creator and an author of NPR's Culture Cosmos and Culture blog and 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. It's a must-read for many of us in the news industry, anybody who cares about science. And he's been writing a lot about he's observing in the conversation about climate change. So this hour, we're talking about reality of climate change. We're going to get to your calls as we go throughout the hour. And if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, let's get back to NASA, because you had a chance to see not only this really remarkable set of understanding and then the evidence that started to layer in and bolster the concern that is now an understood scenario here of what's going on. But that's just one branch of an organization that has frankly done heroic stuff for decades. And you recently wrote about this, and I cited it on Monday when a gentleman called the program. And I want you to explain the dissonance you see. Well, not with most people anymore, but there's still a subset of the American population that has some dissonance about NASA.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's enough people, including people who control the budget in, you know, the Congress, that it's significant. So, you know, the amazing thing about NASA is that, you know, it has been heroic, right, for most Americans, right? They've made their mistakes and everything. But when you look at the kind of things that they have done, the moon landing, the, you know, sending probes to Jupiter and Saturn, those amazing pictures of Saturn's ring. And then recently, right, the string of successes on Mars, right? The being able to land, you know, an SUV on Mars, right? And land it with the sky crane, right? The last one, the way they landed it, where they had to have, you know, basically a rocket tether the thing down to the surface. Amazing, right?
It's amazing, right?
So these guys are incredible with what they do. And of course, they have to be right. You know, you don't get much tolerance for being wrong when you're sending something a billion miles out
and spending billions of dollars.
You know, when something goes wrong and they lose something, everybody's on their case for wasting, you know, $100 million. So we expect that NASA is going to be accurate. We respect it for its accuracy. We look to it as being sort of the triumph of American science, right? And then, you know, there's a whole part of NASA which has always been studying the Earth. Why? Because it's a planet. You know, that's what NASA does. And so when NASA, you know, which has been a large part of the study of climate, says, you know, climate change is happening, it's because of us, all of a sudden, at least for these people, it's like, oh, NASA's lying. Oh, those liberal scientists in NASA. It's like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? What, were the liberal scientists the one who got the you know, the Mars probe down? This has nothing to do with politics, right? The agency of NASA, they apply the same standards to their climate science as they do, because it's all about satellites, etc., as they do to their Mars probe. So it's like this weird dissonance about, like, only on this subject should we now suddenly think NASA's a bunch of a cabal of, you know, conspirators.
And you think, if we want to boil this down to a political divide, and that is one of the most unfortunate parts of the conversation about climate, it should not be political. I understand the policy application could get into politics, and I understand that.
Yeah, sure.
But the question of the science should not be political. Unfortunately, in some cases, it is. But if we want to get all the way down to that level, some of the people who are more likely to, you know, proudly wave American flags or talk about patriotism more often or talk about American exceptionalism, shouldn't they be looking at climate science and saying, that is American exceptionalism?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the history of American science or the role of America and American science in climate is itself a heroic story. So, like, for example, back in the 1950s, we had the Cold War, right? And the military was very concerned about climate and weather, right? It's obvious, especially if you're fighting with the Soviet Union over the, you know, the North Pole. So, you know, they really wanted to study climate. And one of the things they decided to do was to build a base under the ice in Greenland, right? And so, you know, 300 miles on this, you know, unbelievably inhospitable terrain, they dragged a nuclear reactor, right? This is what the American military did. So they could then dig under the ice, and they created, like, literally, you know, it's like some sort of, like, a James Bond thing, a base under the ice. And that was one of the first places where the ice cores were dug, where we got the 10,000-year-long climate history of the Earth. So we have done amazing things. And it just never ceases to amaze me at why, you know, the people who are in are denying, right? And we can talk in a minute exactly what denial means. But the people who are so steadfast in their denial aren't, like, you know, celebrating this triumph of the American military, of the American scientific establishment. You know, people gave their lives to do this. Just two guys recently died out on the ice, two scientists. They were trying to measure ice thickness. And, you know, they went way out on the ice and then they were never heard from again. I mean, there's been a lot of lives that have been lost on this. So it's like, you know, what is the problem?
Talking to Adam Frank from the University of Rochester. He is an author. You've seen his work on NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. He's written a couple of books. He does write on occasion for a number of publications, including the New York Times. And we're talking about climate science, the triumph of climate science, where we're going next. And in a moment, we are going to talk a little bit about the state of denial. I mean, I think that's it's part of it. We're not going to spend the hour fielding calls on denial. And I did, before I get a phone call in here, because the phone is kind of blown up now, I did make a distinction. I'm curious to know if you agree with, Adam, which is that I think the word skepticism should be treasured. I mean, I think skepticism is a very important thing in general. I think it's great to be a skeptic, really, about anything. I mean, right. It's valuable.
All good scientists are skeptics. If you're not a skeptic, then you're doing a lousy job as a scientist.
Absolutely. And this program has pegged skepticism as a great value. And yet, I hear people use the term climate skeptic, and I think they're sort of appropriating a term inappropriately anymore. That's why I gently told a caller on Monday, I said, you know, I understand what you are telling me, but I would say denier and not skeptic. Does the term skeptic when it comes to climate, does that bother you?
Yeah, depending on where they're coming from. I mean, you know, but if so let's be clear about what denial means. I mean, there's many levels, but the one that I think is most obvious for me and has to do with the story you told is that the overwhelming consensus of the people who actually study climate, you know, who do the work every day, that's their job. The overwhelming consensus in that field is that the Earth is, the climate is changing, and it's changing because of human activity. If you're not on board with that, then you are denying reality. I mean, I could say it's not true, but that wouldn't change that. You know what I mean? Like, there is a reality out there for the people who live it, right? And if you say that's not true, that it's not happening, oh no, that's not true that all the scientists, look at all these other scientists who don't think that climate change is happening, you know, you're denying what is actually happening. And then, of course, if, you know, you have to accept that. And if you accept that, then you're only left with two options. They're lying, right? Or they're idiots, right? And, you know, neither of those makes a lot of sense. So unless you want to take they're lying or they're idiots, and there's counters to that, then you're stuck with the idea that, like, yeah, okay, everybody who studies this field, you know, the best for 50 years, you know, billions of dollars, thousands and thousands of hours of human effort have led us to the idea, you know, led us to the conclusion that the climate is changing. What are you going to do?
And the idea that they're lying, I often hear those who say that they are lying, is that because they're venal? You know, that they just want the money to keep flowing. When if you are a scientist and you can peer review and study and actually poke a hole in it, that's where the money's going to be.
Right.
If you
scientists love beating the crap out of each other. we're, you know, everybody's an idiot. All the people you're working against are idiots. And from their perspective, you're an idiot too. I mean, as scientists, we're horrible to each other. And the other thing about the money makes no sense, because people, that means they don't understand how science gets funded, right? If I get a grant, right, the money goes mainly to my students, right? If I get 10 more grants, my salary doesn't go up by a factor of 10. For, you know, scientists working at NASA, their salary is what their salary is. If they bring in a lot more money for research, it means they get to hire young scientists to work with them. It doesn't go into a Maserati, right? So this is a weird idea about how science gets funded or what it means to have the money flowing.
Yeah. We did talk on this program on Monday in our monthly science roundtable about the state of grant funding in science, and how, and some of your colleagues from the University of Rochester indicated that, you know, the University of Rochester's grant application success is higher than the average across the country, and that's still only about 1 in 4. Right now, about 90% of grant applications are declined, and that's because NIH and other scientific funding has steadily been eroded through Congress.
Right.
The sequester
has really devastated science funding in this country.
So when it comes to denial, I think some people will look at that and they say, well, a scientist just wants the tap to keep flowing. But now that we have had decades of scientific agreement, I would think just logically, and you could tell me if I'm wrong, that you're not likely to get to be one out of 10 projects that gets funded if you say, well, I'm just going to agree with a bunch of colleagues. Again, if you really want to make a splash and you are right, that's probably where the money would be.
Well, right. So we're poking holes in each other's. I mean, there's an enormous amount of debate in climate science, right? But the debate is not whether about climate is changing, right? Just like there's an enormous amount of debate in star formation studies, which is, you know, my main area. But the basic idea that stars form from clouds, from clouds collapsing on themselves, we've known that since, 1903 with Jeans' work, So it's like, there's things that you debate about and there's things that you know. And if you want to argue against one of those bedrock things, you better have some pretty damn good evidence, right? And nobody has. So that's why that part is considered established and they fight about other things.
To some degree, you feel like we've just got to stop airing out the is it or it isn't.
Oh, that's got to be done. We've got to be done with that. We've got to be finished with that because it's first of all, it has nothing to do with reality, the reality of our understanding. It is enormously damaging to our national scientific effort, right? Because really, these people are saying, oh, they're all lying. What are you telling young kids if you're saying that? So I was just, Bill Nye was at the U of R, and I got invited to go, do an early meeting with him and a bunch of students. And then I went to the meeting itself, and there must have been like 2,000 students there who loved Bill Nye. These were all like science and engineering students who were like, Bill. It was an army, And so these are the people who are going to solve our problems, either in climate or in computers or build the next kind of cool car. And so you're telling all them, oh, these scientists are liars, Oh, good move, right? I mean, you can't damn climate science without damning all of science, right? Because you can't make that distinction.
And this is where it's strange, again, to me, the notion of denying it is happening. We're at an important point. We've got, as Adam has said on this program before, we're exiting the childhood of our species.
Right.
We're entering at least the teenage years or hopefully adulthood where we can make some important decisions if we're going to hang around here for a while, because the planet will be here. We just don't know if we will be. But it's also an exciting time because imagine you spend years looking to buy a house and you can't decide. And finally you buy a house and then finally you can decide, well, what kind of furniture am I going to put in? What am I going to paint the walls? And imagine if a year after you finally bought the house, you're still saying to your wife, I'm going to go look at other houses. She'll say, no, we have the house now.
Right.
Now we're tweaking.
Right.
We are tweaking our understanding of what it means to be living here.
Right.
And that's kind of where we are. It should be exciting,
right?
Even if it's a little harrowing.
Right. Well, because again, it's, there's a one way when you think about climate change, which is kind of awesome. We, as a species, we've become so powerful that we have changed inadvertently the climate of an entire planet. I mean, yo, man. I mean, that's, pretty, on some level, can I use the A word? Bad arse. it's amazing the strength of sort of what we've been able to do. So the question now is, what do we do about it? Right? I mean, there's a certain level at which climate change is not our fault. And what I mean by that is that when we started, with fossil fuels, we had no idea. We found this fuel, this goo. It was awesome. We could do awesome things with it. And so, it wasn't because of human greed and meanness and evilness that we got to this point. But if we don't do something, it is our fault, right? And this is where the partisanship makes no sense. The conservative and Republican views on this have got to be part of it. It's the only way you're going to have a solution. The solution to climate change is going to require everybody's best ideas because it does involve things like the economy, choices of technology.
Innovation.
It's not, and including social and economic innovation. And so the idea that Democrats are the only ones who are going to be able to, provide solutions is crazy. So we've got to get off this sort of thing that this is a Democrat versus Republican or conservative versus liberal issue and start talking about what do we do? What are our best bets? Because it's a bet. We don't know that our bets will work out. But what's our best bet for dealing with this?
And along those lines of what is helping or hindering the debate, do you occasionally take issue with people who have very well-intentioned, who would probably call themselves environmentalists, but who kind of shame our species, that we're all greedy and venal and corporations are bad and look what we're doing, we're terrible? Do you take an issue with that line of thinking sometimes?
Yeah, because I think part of the thing, there's been research on this. One of the things about this amazing divide in the country, the partisan divide about climate, is often the way the story gets told. And it often is told from an environmentalist perspective. And I'm an environmentalist and everything, but, I recognize that climate change is not the opportunity for my environmentalist political policies to get instituted. That's not it. We don't know exactly what the solution is going to be. It clearly involves getting away from fossil fuels. But, you know, like I said, you're going to need a lot of different options. And this story that, oh, human beings are inherently evil and bad and we're a plague upon the planet, you know, that just, to me, that doesn't work. It's not actually what happened. We are part of nature, right? What we've done is part of nature. And our intelligence and our ability to make choices is also part of nature. So, you know, this thing that's happening, there's going to be changes to the planet, right? You know, you can't have 9 billion of us on the planet without changes, some changes that are going to be hard. Like, you know, will there be polar bears? I don't know, right? I don't know if, you know, that's certain things we're going to have to allow to change if we're going to both manage to having, you know, the planet be healthy, the biosphere be healthy, and human civilization be healthy. It's going to be a cooperative interaction between them. You know, the planet's changed before. We're changing it again. So that, you know, sort of the idea that, you know, somehow we need to remove ourselves is the only solution just doesn't do it for me.
I will get to the phones in a minute. I appreciate the folks who are waiting there to jump into the conversation with Adam Frank as we talk about climate science this hour. But to put it in context, when Adam is saying climate change wasn't our fault, and it's our fault now that we know about it if we don't do anything about it. The context is, if we are not the only guys in this universe, guys, men, women, and intelligent beings beyond singular cellular stuff, there's a pretty good chance climate change happens on every planet that develops.
Well, yeah, that's something I'm working on now, this idea that, like, pretty much what's happening to us now, we should understand, in some sense, as a thing that planets do, right? Planets, probably life evolves on lots of planets. Some of those planets, life probably reaches the point of intelligence and technology, harvesting energy, using that energy to build societies, to make, you know, to increase the energy available per individual in that species. And if you do that, there's feedbacks. Depending on your planet's initial conditions, the feedbacks may take a long time. Depending on where you are, the feedbacks may happen pretty quickly. On Earth, we just happen to be in a place where the feedbacks happen pretty fast, right? So this, what's in some sense, our entry into a climate-changed era, you can say, is natural, right? It's a natural thing that planets do, right? And now, because it involved intelligence, intelligence can make choices. And so we're either going to make choices that allow us to continue, or we're going to make choices that lead to our own collapse. Right.
For our friends and our listeners who've seen Good Will Hunting, those who accept climate science and are feeling bad about ourselves, Adam is Robin Williams saying to Matt Damon, it's not your fault. It's not your fault.
That's what I'm doing. I'm doing, hey, man, come here.
It's not your fault. And that's it's a fascinating scenario. So before I get to the phones, let me just put a fine point on the whole NASA conversation, because this is important. Earlier this year, we briefly touched on it, but let's spell this out. Congress moved, at least the committee, and hold on, let me pull it up here because I don't remember. It's which committee was it, Adam? It was one of those committees.
This one was in the Senate, it might have been.
It was the House Science, no, this was the House. Oh, okay. House Science, Space, and Technology Committee. It was headed by a Texas Republican named Lamar Smith, and they moved to cut $300 million from NASA's Earth Science budget. They claimed that by doing that, it would force NASA to focus more of its efforts on space and not our own planet, even though I don't know why Congress is telling NASA what to do about that.
Right.
Here's the quote, by the way, from NASA's agency administrator, Charles Bolden, after Congress moved to cut $300 million from NASA's, essentially their climate science budget. Quote, gutting our Earth science program and threatening to set back generations worth of progress in better understanding our climate is a very serious situation. That's what we're looking at here. That's what Charles Bolden had to say. What did you make of it?
Well, yes. To me, you know, it's basically, it's you know, it's kind of Orwellian in a sense. Look, if we just get people to stop saying climate change, no one will think about it. You know, I mean, it's the same thing that's happened in Florida, and I guess it's Wisconsin also, where, like, you know, the government has, you know, you cannot use the word climate change in official documents. And that's what they're trying to do here. And also, particularly going after NASA, right? That was my point. NASA, you know, what I said in the article is NASA is like Superman to people. And so what they want to do, and because they know, like, if NASA says, hey, climate change is happening, you know, people who really may not be into science are like, oh, well, I believe NASA. I love that Mars probes that they did. So, you know, by getting NASA to shut up in particular, then they're really, you know, they're heading that off at the pass. So, you know, the argument was like they're trying to be kryptonite to NASA's Superman. So there's a particular reason to go after NASA because of the role it plays in the public imagination.
And interestingly, that $300 million cut appears to have at least been held up for now.
Yeah.
So there was an outcry about it, but we'll see.
keep trying going forward.
And that's where the concern about partisanship comes in, that we have to get past this partisanship. And even here, this is a sort of a small local example. But on Monday on this program, the reason we discuss climate is because tonight at the Harley School from 7 to 9, there is a free candidates forum on building a sustainable economy. And that, who knows exactly what that means? It means one thing in Portland, where they've got a pretty interesting and complex plan. It means another thing in Vancouver, where they've got 9 major prongs and 50 sub-prongs. You can read on their website. Other cities and states and counties haven't really done anything on the local level. So what this group, which is the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, is trying to do is they're trying to find out if you're a candidate for office, if you want to be a victor, town supervisor, or the mayor of Rochester, which is not an election this year, or county executive, or on city council, or on the county legislature, do you view climate as worth addressing, even in a mitigation sense, on the local level? No Republicans are going to be there tonight. You know, I know they're busy, and certainly Cheryl Denolfo, who's been generous with her time on this program, and we hope to have her back for the election. She's running for county executive. She's busy. She's the only county executive candidate who's not there. She happens to be a Republican. All other Republicans who were invited tonight have declined. Meanwhile, more than a dozen others will be there. And it just feels like it's too much of a coincidence that one party's declining, and it gives me a little bit of... You're an optimist. It gives me a little bit of pessimism.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what the art we've got. That's what I'm saying. We just have got to get past this. We have to, you know, there's so much intelligence, you know, in, you know, and, you know, fiscal conservancy, you know, there's things there that definitely are probably could be very useful for, you know, thinking about how you switch, because it's a big deal. We're switching infrastructures, right? We're going to try and switch infrastructures from a fossil fuel based infrastructure to something else. We need everybody on board to figure out how to do this. So the idea of like pretending it's not happening is just not, you know, that's a choice. That is, but it's a very dangerous choice. Right?
All right, we're late for a break. Let's get our break. We're coming back to the phones with Adam Frank. We are talking climate science this hour. Your phone calls are next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, all about what it's like to be a dairy farmer in 2015. From animal husbandry to caring for the environment to what the word sustainable really means to farmers. We've got a panel. They'll be in studio. They're all from a short drive from Rochester. They'll take your questions and comments as well. It's next hour on Connections.
With so many Republican presidential candidates, the market for political professionals is tight.
This year, it's difficult to find staff because there's so many campaigns.
Qualified operatives could take advantage of a bidding war.
If you want to be a mover and shaker, then I think you should really stay with the one who brought you.
The boom market in Iowa politics later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. The University of Rochester's Adam Frank is here. He is, among many other things, an author of a couple of books and a third in the works that might include some of these subjects we're talking about this hour. He is the co-creator and an author of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog, where a lot of his focus in recent months has been on questions and public conversations about climate science and climate change. He's written for the New York Times and many others. He's our guest in studio for the hour. And first up on the phones is John in Hilton. Go ahead, John.
Thank you. A comment and a question. I think we're beating a dead horse on this a little bit. It's settled science, I agree. Let's just treat it like it's settled science and move on. We sort of spend our time too much on talking about the deniers. My question is, figuring globally, can we calculate or do we have an idea of how much CO2 or carbon the planet can handle? And if we can do that, can we calculate how much it works out to equally divide by 6 billion to figure out each person on the planet would be allocated so much? And then finally, what do we use? How much carbon do I use as a typical American? Or how much CO2 am I emitting? Where do I stand against that calculation? you understand what I'm...
Yeah, no, these are all great questions. Let me address the first one. So the idea of like how much the planet can handle, you know, the planet can handle a lot more. There's a lot of CO2 locked up in various places. And, you know, there's been periods when the planet has been a lot warmer, right? So the question is not what the planet can handle. The question is what can human civilization handle, right? Human civilization in its modern form is a bunch of tightly coupled, sensitive networks, transportation, energy, economy. And the question is, how much can you stress those before bad things begin to happen? You know, you're looking at what's going on with Syria right now in the refugee crisis, and you already see how much Europe is getting stressed. You know, if we get into bad climate territory, there's going to be a lot of refugees fleeing from places where you can't grow food anymore. So along those lines, people have said that the number that where things get dangerous is an increase of 2 degrees, on average over the planet, 2 degrees centigrade. And the number, if I believe that corresponds to in terms of carbon, is I think about 300 gigatons of carbon released. There is another number you have to understand is that the total amount of carbon that we could use in fossil fuels is 5 times that amount. So, we cannot go above, we can't use more than is going to go around, that's going to take us above 2 degrees. And that's where the urgency in switching infrastructures comes from. And so I know there's websites that will allow you to calculate your own. Like every time you ride in an airplane, you're using a lot. I mean, this is, so you can try and mitigate your own climate or carbon use as much as possible. I don't really know what the average person does, though.
John, I hope that helps. Thanks for the phone call. We're going to get through as many of your comments and calls for the rest of the hour. We have a flood in many different forms. A different John writes and says, Evan, there actually is some debate about whether the sky is blue. Radiolab did an interesting story about this a few years ago. He's right. Oh, you got me there. Different John. And he says, on another note, since you are arguing that we should follow science as best we can without regard to partisanship, I look forward to your segment on the scientific consensus that GMOs are safe. John, I don't dispute the point. I've been reading a lot about GMOs recently.
No, it's a good point. And I mean, we have denial has been reaching across a whole bunch of different domains, and somehow the science and politics, we've got to figure out how to have the scientific debate without falling into the political debate.
Yeah.
Or how to separate those two so they can inform each other.
Steve on Twitter just wants to say that this guy is great. This guy is Adam Frank. Thank you, Steve.
My mother thanks you.
Dave says there is controversy, but not what they say. The controversy is, can we reverse this or are we past the point of no return? My concern is we're already too far into CO2 in oceans and acidification. So, Adam?
I think it's exactly what he says. That's where the debate is. And, at this point, it's too early to tell sort of what the answer to that is. But, I think there's a lot of reason to hope. We have, like, all those students, man, those students I was talking about at the talk by Bill Nye, they're ready to go. They are ready to go to come up with solutions to this problem. We're an ingenious species. We're an ingenious country. And so let's unleash that creative power.
One other quick point from the same person on Twitter, Dave, writes, it is still possible that we're wrong about climate change, and recognizing that it is possible would enable the deniers, yes, but it's necessary for intellectual honesty. I would just say to Dave, from my own perspective, and Adam will address this in a minute, I'm always open to new evidence. The evidence is mountainous now.
Yeah.
But I guess we're always open to new evidence.
Yeah,
right?
Sure, of course. I mean, it's possible we're wrong. It's possible we're wrong about general relativity. But, one thing also to understand about the way science progresses, right? It's not like when Einstein came along, it's not like we said, goodbye, Newton, you're done. We're never going to use your equations again. It was an extension of what we understood, because Newtonian dynamics had been so firmly grounded that what Einstein did was went beyond it and showed that it was a limiting case of something. There's things we know about climate now that are just rock solid. They're never going to change, right? They're beyond that point. We use them for our understanding of Mars and of Venus and of Titan. That's what the article I wrote last week about that, the triumph of climate science is that it's not just the Earth that we're using this for. We're using it for exoplanets. So there's some foundational parts about climate that it's really hard to imagine that those can be overturned.
Okay. Back to the phones, and Rich in Rochester. Next up with Adam Frank. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good.
Good.
I understand all the points that we're talking about, the scientists and the arguments, but this points to the old lead in the cigarette argument that was started. The lead thing started by, was it Robert Keel? There are interests out there on the economic side who don't want to see these changes happen. And if they know if they muddy the waters enough, they can delay this. My question is, number one, if we find out right that this did happen like we did in the lead industry and in the cigarette industry, we have to do more than just fine people. We have these things cost lives. And then people purposely use these tactics, knowing that these tactics are going to muddy the water, and knowing that what they're saying is just to do that. They know that the science is real. It's not about them believing that the science is real on certain in certain venues. It's about muddying the water so their interests are protected. Those are the ones that will also have a lot of politicians' ears, and that's what this is about. People keep talking about the science. This is not about the science. You can't separate the politics and the economics of this. And to keep chirping that doesn't solve the problem, because until we attack the politics and the economics on the left side and on the cigarette side, nothing changed. And I think I understand, Adam, your position of the science, but this is not about the science. And that's what you have to start concentrating on. And I think there should be some sort of criminal repercussions for people who do this stuff purposely. And that's what's going on. Even though no one wants to say it, it is going on. It happened with lead. It happened with cigarettes. It happened with other industries.
Well, listen, I agree with you that it's time to sort of shift. You know, that's the whole point of sort of today's thing. It's time to shift the debate. And this was what's so great about the Pope's the encyclical on climate, right? And I wrote about this, the idea like, okay, it's time to move away from is it happening to what do we do, right? And then, you know, it's a moral question. It is a moral question now of what we do. There will be suffering unless we take action. And so then, you know, let's have the debate about the moral responsibility of alleviating future suffering. So I agree completely. But unfortunately, you know, as you rightly point out, what has happened since sort of like the mid-2000s, it was the very concerted effort to sow doubt, to create doubt where no doubt actually existed or no doubt should exist. And so we need, you know, part of what we're talking about today is firmly putting that to rest, and now let's begin to understand what it will look like to start formulate policies, and that is the domain of politics, that can try and alleviate this.
Aaron writes to us on Twitter, why are denialists, well, denialists, passionate and vehement denialists? Is it only because of perceived economic cost? That's from Aaron on Twitter. I would say, Adam, I'm curious to get your take on this. Yeah, I recently read the New York Times article about the research of what would happen if all fossil fuels were burned. And thankfully, we're not going to do that tomorrow.
Right.
It would be really, really, really bad. But even in that article, the researcher said, even if we burned all of the remaining fossil fuels, the resultant sea level rise and the impact would still be our grandchildren's grandchildren's right. generation. And for most people, you know, it's hard to think long term, past your own decade, let alone past your own lifetime, let alone past your children's lifetime.
Right.
So we have to find a way to do that, because most people aren't going to see the most negative possible consequences. And I think that being the case, I think time limits people.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, this is about the maturation of the species, right? The only way to really deal with this is to start thinking on century-long timescales, right? And we are not genetically programmed to do that, right? We're genetically programmed to worry about the panther about to drop on our necks. But that's what evolution is about, right? Either you evolve or you die, right? And so here, evolution is requiring of us the ability to plan, you know, multiple generations in the future. And that's what the discussion should be about. It shouldn't be about whether or not climate change is happening, right? What does it mean to plan, you know, six generations, seven generations? You know, that's always that thing about the seven generations of the Native Americans. What does that mean? What does it look like? What's the economic cost? This is where the debate has to begin to shift. And so why denialists are denialists? People have done research on this. And, you know, a lot of times it's about politics because, you know, they've been told by, you know, Rush Limbaugh that if they are conservatives, therefore climate change isn't happening. But there's actually an amazing range of opinions. Sometimes people just want to be told, don't want to be told what to do. They're naturally suspicious, or they're naturally, they feel they're against any large government, you know, sort of anything that seems to be coming from large government. So there's a lot of different reasons.
But we eventually accepted the scientific consensus on lead.
Right.
on if you eat lead candy bars, not good things happening. We accepted the scientific consensus on tobacco.
Right.
And we're on our way, and I guess it's just a question of, you know, when the larger public is in the same place as we have come to with lead, tobacco, et cetera. Back to the phones, and Dan in Bergen. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi. I missed the beginning of the program, so perhaps you covered it, but I doubt it. I have kind of like 2 points to make. Over the many years of watching the subject, two items that have kind of dropped off the radar over all these years, and I've been waiting for them to be mentioned over and over again, and they just never are, is there were two ideas suggested. One was that NASA put a probe between the Earth and the Sun and act like Venetian blinds and kind of cool the planet that way, and it would cost only about $100 million, so it's cheap by, you know, relative to all the costs, but I know it has geopolitical consequences because it would affect, you know, all humans on the planet, and computer models would have to be set up for any kind of worst-case scenarios to try something like that. But you never hear it mentioned or suggested as a possible cheap alternative to trying to get this problem under control. The other one happened right after 9/11 when the FAA banned all air flights over the continental United States, and there was an observation. Of course, nobody knew 9/11 was going to happen, so it kind of took everybody by surprise. But I remember seeing on the news in 2001 that the temperature of the planet dropped a full degree while the planes were out of the sky, and then it went back to, quote, normal, unquote, or the new normal after the planes returned to the sky. Now we've got all these many years have gone by, and I've never, and of course, that's going to be devastating to the airline industry, but I thought, well, you know, what if we ban flights on Sundays? You know, over a period of from 2001 to 2015, would we have seen a marked effect with you know, no economic crisis thrust on the airlines? Is anybody else aware of these two observations that have been made over the years, and has there been any further study on any of these as options?
Dan in Bergen, thanks for the call. Adam, let's start with the Venetian blinds for the solar system. It's an interesting idea.
Well, so this falls under what's called geoengineering, right? There's a lot of proposals that have been out there, and certainly the blind is one of them. And recently, even the National Academy of Sciences said, okay, look, we at least need to study geoengineering. But what they said was, because this is the problem, if you get to the point where you're trying to geoengineer the planet to solve this problem, then you need to recognize the unbelievable amount of or possibility of unintended consequences, right? Climate change, these are unintended consequences of geoengineering, right? We didn't know we were doing a geoengineering experiment, but here we are. So, you know, you don't want to go down that road because, yeah, okay, we'll put up a sunblind and it'll make the, you know, we'll keep more sun down. Everything will cool down. But, you know, the climate system is so incredibly complicated that it's not, there's not just one knob on it, right? Even, here's the thing, even backing off from CO2, we can't tell exactly what the climate state will look like when we do that, right? I mean, so, you know, you want to do the simplest thing you possibly can rather than trying to, like, you know, put giant machinery all over the planet. So, you know, geoengineering, people, it's been talked about, but everybody's terrified of it. And we should be rightfully terrified. And we've gotten to the point now where, like, things are, you know, make it so bad that we have to at least consider it because, you know, the alternatives will already be so deep in the muck.
Okay, but airlines.
Yeah, airlines, you know, I've heard that. I mean, the 1 degree, I'm very skeptical about that 1 degree. That's a lot. People, so I don't know much about that. I'll say I don't know much about that. I know people looked into it, but I don't think just banning airlines would is a solution.
Or
to the
ban them on Sunday. They'll fly more on Monday and Tuesday.
Yeah, I just don't know enough. So I really there, I'll have to say I don't know. But I don't think it could be that simple.
Yeah, but at least, you know, Dan, these are the kind of conversations, though, that are at least interesting and important
exactly.
to have.
Exactly. Thank you, Dan.
And this is where we want to be going
right.
With some of this. Peter in Rochester, got about 30 seconds for you. Peter, go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much. I think I agree, especially on the geoengineering. But as chair of the Sierra Club here in Rochester, one of the things we've put in our last newsletter was a problem that's part of this, and a major part of it, but never seems to even hit the discussion table, which is population.
Mm.
And that a lot of the effects we are seeing are due to a great amount of population, that if we had a smaller population, a lot of things we are doing now could be sustainable. And if we don't initiate and start having serious talks on population, then I don't know how we can ever reach a satisfactory solution. I think that the United States has to be a leader in this field, because if we have no policy on population ourselves and we're the largest consumer of resources in the world, we can't go around preaching to anybody else about that.
And Peter, thanks for the phone call. On the question of population, I hear so many conflicting things. Who was the Stanford scientist for years who wrote about this in the 60s and 70s?
Population bomb.
Population bomb, right. And in some ways, well, he was certainly wrong about the timing. So he was wrong in many ways about that. And I see a lot of back and forth on this. This is an issue, Peter, that I am going to study as the host of this program and try to bring in people who are very updated on population, because I don't know. I haven't read enough of the recent science. It's an interesting question, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah. No, and it's, you know, population is clearly a part of it. So I think it's, yeah, that's something, having people under, bringing people in who are experts in this, and how you can top the, you know, both stop the growth of population, because it's growing less than it was before, you know, but it's still growing. And then, you know, what are the things that keep us from bringing it down to, you know.
Yeah. And Fred Guterl, the executive editor of Scientific American, on this program last year said female empowerment. Yep. Particularly in places like Africa, where that just doesn't exist in many places, is a good step. I got about a minute left, Adam, real briefly, in 15 seconds, for anybody who says, well, climate change is this new science, and it's new, and it'll be debunked. You've written on NPR's blog, it goes back a couple hundred years.
Yeah, it goes back to at least the early 1800s or mid-1800s when Joseph Tyndall figured out that, like, oh, certain gases were very good at, you know, storing solar energy or holding on to energy. So, you know, the discovery of greenhouse gases goes back to the mid-1800s. 1903, Sven Arrhenius did a paper that showed, like, oh, you know, all this coal burning actually affects the Earth's warming. And he was like, hey, you know, he lived in Sweden. So he's like, hey, climate change, great, I want it, you know. So we've known for, you know, more than 100 years about climate change. This is not a new science in many ways.
And for the callers who said, boy, we've really got to move on beyond the denial, that's what this hour has been all about. It was Adam's idea, I think, to help push it forward. And you really ought to read his writing on a regular basis on NPR.org. It's the 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog, among so many other things you're doing. I guess we'll just have to keep talking about There is, but we're going to come back and we're going to continue the kinds of conversations that are interesting, even if they feel like non-starters or not viable. We've got to get creative.
Right.
Business class has got to help.
Right.
The innovation class has got to help. Thank you, Adam.
Pleasure.
Always a great pleasure
Always
to have Adam
pleasure.
Frank. Short break, and hey, let's talk about cows. That's next.